You're listening to the A Connector Podcast with host Mark Foreman. Let's get connecting. Yeah. Hello, this is your host, Mark Foreman, the Brooklyn Blues Man. Today, I'm going to be talking about democracy, in particular, Taiwanese Taiwan democracy. Taiwan the Minzu. Taiwan the Minzu Fazan. Yisu. Wenhua. So, yeah, talking about Taiwan democracy, a little bit about the history of it, a little bit about the local democratic culture. So let me kind of preface this by saying that before I arrived in Taiwan some over 30 years ago, I was studying Chinese language, Chinese history, Chinese culture, as well as some other Asian history and culture classes back at my alma mater, the University of Arizona. Yeah, go Wildcats. So anyhow, back in that time, we studied mostly about China and like the dynastic period. So we didn't really cover Taiwan all that much. Now, saying that, most of my teachers were either born in Taiwan or they perhaps were born in China or their parents were born in China and they were born in Taiwan. And I remember beyond that, I think I also have one that might have been born in China, but then kind of grew up in Hong Kong, etc. So anyhow, just to give some background, I mean, when I was a kid and just, Taiwan was in the news, with all the political stuff and Taiwan being an ally of the U.S., Taiwan was talked about, of course, as Taiwan, and I knew there was a Republic of China. I also knew there was a Formosa. I knew there was a Free China. In a democratic China, these were all names that were ascribed to Taiwan. Now, I didn't realize why there were so many of them, but I've come to learn the reasons, and maybe I'll get into it in this episode. I'm going to probably break this up into a few episodes so they don't go too long, because I think it's noteworthy and it merits putting a little time in to give the topic justice. So, finally, I studied Chinese at the University of Arizona. What I realized, which I was having a lot of fun with it, I always loved languages. I come from a family that had, a lot of linguistic aptitude. My grandmother spoke about 10 different languages, I was told. I studied starting Spanish. Started studying Spanish when, probably junior high school, something like that. Obviously, there's New York City where I'm from. There are a lot of Hispanic people, and I thought it was a practical language because obviously it was spoken some around New York City. I mean, English, of course, was the main language, but there was some Spanish there. I thought it'd be good to practice that. And then when I went to Arizona, I continued with that because, of course, Arizona is close to Mexico. In fact, used to be part of Mexico. And anyway, so now it came around to studying Chinese. Now, how did I decide to study Chinese? It was probably at a point about a year into my college studies. And like a lot of young people, I thought I wanted to do one thing and then realized I had no clue what I really wanted to do. I was started as a political science major and I was taking some government classes and whatnot. And it was okay, but I was thinking initially, perhaps going into law, and I felt that I could probably make a good lawyer, but I thought I would be a miserable lawyer because the view I had of lawyers was basically hard-ass people that take advantage of people in their moment of weakness or manipulate their knowledge of law, which is like code. It's very arcane and they take advantage of that and make a lot of money off of people's misfortunes or time of trouble. Now, whether that's true or not, I'll leave that up to everyone to decide or what they think. I mean, I think to a certain extent, yes, there probably are a lot of lawyers that are like that. I'm sure not all, but that's kind of the view that I had, and I felt that was pretty much the mold, and I didn't want to really do that. I felt there had to be some other way to make a living or find something that, you know, would be more interesting and less harmful to people. So what that was, I had no clue. But anyway, it was time. I was looking at the second year of classes at school, and I was, you know, flipping around the catalog. This is pre-online, so I mean, we actually had a thick paper catalog, little book, and I saw, you know, just some different classes, and I saw one class which was Chinese poetry, poems from China, and it was in English. And I started taking that, and it was really nice. I mean, I was a liberal arts major. I was kind of into the arts and culture. I used to run a jazz club, like a free jazz club. We called it Loft Jazz, actually, at the time back in New York, because Soho, which is kind of famous now for expensive shopping, at that time was pretty derelict. They were old factory buildings, loft buildings, basically. What is a loft building? A loft building is a building that where basically one floor runs like the whole one suite or one apartment or whatever. Yeah, it's the entire floor of this building. And they were all industrial. They all had factories. So maybe a factory had three or four floors. Could have been the whole building or just, you know, one floor. And so they did not have individually partitioned rooms. But then as manufacturing moved out of the city government started to give incentives to the landlords who were sitting on a lot of empty properties down there, like, hey, why don't you make these spaces available to artists? And I guess they gave out some tax subsidy or whatever. And, you know, so they started to fill up with artists, different performing artists. And in fact, I didn't realize at first, but the people that were renting this space, I thought it was the club or the performance space I was working with, which was called Enveron. It was on Broadway in Manhattan. And then I came to realize later on, in fact, the renter of this space were a couple of brothers named Brubeck. Now, if any of you know anything about jazz or jazz history, there was a very famous musician named Dave Brubeck that played around with different time signatures, had some Grammy-winning records, very talented guy. He was kind of a flashpoint to a certain extent because there were many probably equally, if not more talented black jazz musicians that felt like, wow, you know, here we are again, that, you know, some issues of privilege. And that might be the case. I don't know. But I mean, you know, his music was pretty good, but I could certainly understand that point. I don't think it was the authentic, really rootsy, really fiery, what I would call, original jazz, because jazz is basically an African American music, and I have no problem stating that for the record. But anyhow, be that as it may, two of his sons had the loft, so they kind of lived off on one side, and the rest of the space they shared with this guy John Fisher, who was running the place. So. Okay, so that's a little bit about my background. So I listened to a lot of music. I was a collector. I was very interested in culture. Like I said, primarily music, but, you know, things like poetry as well. So here I was, and I'm at school, and I see a class in Chinese poetry. I said, you know, just on a lark, sure, I'll take that. You know, I'm trying to figure out really what I want to do. So in the meantime, let me take something that sounds interesting. You know, I don't know that I can make a penny from that. I didn't care. I just wanted to do something to feed my mind a little bit and have some fun. And I did that, and I loved it. And I got this crazy idea. The idea was that maybe someday, because, you know, I'm getting back to my language thing, perhaps if I studied Chinese, someday I could read these poems in their native language. Because when you talk about something like poetry in particular, it's so nuanced that when you go from one language to another, you can't really get a full 100% translation. I mean, you could approximate, but you lose some things in translation because, you know, poetry is such a special artistic, nuanced way of speaking. So I got that crazy idea. So sure enough, I checked in the catalog, and lo and behold, they do teach Chinese at school, and so I started studying it. And after my first year, I realized, like, oh wow, I have like the basic requirements for my major with just that first year if I take it for another year and end up doing that and taking some other classes. So that's kind of like the capsule background on my college education in Oriental Studies and Chinese in particular. So again, you know, I had some conversations with my teachers and whatnot. Sure, they mentioned being from Taiwan. Even one of them, I remember mentioning a Taiwanese language. Now, I had no clue that China had a lot of different languages. And in fact, they were called dialects. But I think that's not so accurate. I think they are more accurately languages. China will say that they are dialects and the national language is Mandarin. Then, of course, there's Cantonese, which they call the Cantonese dialect. But I think basically that's a language. I think basically what it was is, you know, China, in a sense, is kind of like Europe, meaning one key difference. Obviously, China is a lot bigger, but China got bigger not in and of their own right under their own Chinese rule, but it was actually under the Mongols during the Yuan Dynasty that China became the biggest it ever was. So it incorporated a lot of land that was China and from outside China. So you really, it's a melting pot. You have a lot of different races and nationalities that were in there. Now they're, you know, they're all called Chinese because they're under the Chinese political structure. But in fact, there are different cultures and different languages and some kind of, just like Europe, some of them are kind of similar, like Spanish and Portuguese. But then you might have like Spanish and Hungarian, where there's not really that much of a connection in the same way with some of the dialects or other Chinese languages. So, you know, we talked about some stuff and, you know, didn't really get a lot of background. Now, I knew around that time I wanted to come here, which was like in 1987, that the Taiwan had been under martial law for quite a while. And most of it was under Chiang Kai-shek, whose actual Chinese name in Mandarin is Chiang Jieshi. And so I think Chiang Kai-shek is probably more like the Cantonese pronunciation. And so he passed away. And then the next president was his son, Chiang Jingguo. And so I guess Chiang Jingguo decided to repeal martial law and wanted to make things more democratic. Now, in the meantime, Taiwan had already been thriving economically. They had a good relationship with the U.S., as I stated. So the U.S. government wanted to reward Taiwan with some preferential trade terms and whatnot because Taiwan had been a good partner. Actually, the U.S. military had bases here during the Vietnam War, particularly in the town I live in, which is called Taichung. It's in the central part of Taiwan, a big Air Force base over here called CCK. And so I guess the vets from the Vietnam War, the soldiers, they used to, one of the spots that would come for rest and relaxation was to Taiwan, and a lot of them to Taichung. There used to be all kinds of bars over there, and I've heard a lot of different stories about those times, pretty colorful, as you can imagine, whenever soldiers and sailors that are at war go. And anyway, okay, so getting back to Chiang Jingguo, from what I've heard from a lot of local Taiwanese, they really had affection for him because the position that Chiang Kai-shek took was always that Taiwan was like a staging ground. Come here, regroup, go back to mainland China and take it back. So he never had any interest in really developing Taiwan, putting any resources into it, making any effort to really win the hearts and minds of the local people. In fact, it might be quite to the contrary. There was a lot of what was called white terror. He was basically more or less a dictator. He was the generalissimo during his time in China, because Chiang Kai-shek, before he came to Taiwan, obviously the China was called the Republic of China, and the ruling party was the KMT, the Kuomintang, and so that was him. And so, in fact, he had two sons. One of them, Chiang Jingguo, who I've mentioned, later was the president here in Taiwan. He sent to the Soviet Union to basically learn from them. And the other one he sent to Nazi Germany. So you can get an idea from that, kind of the sign of the times and the zeitgeist back then. So anyhow, but Zhang Jingguo, I guess, started to realize at some point, like, well, you know, I don't think my dad's vision of retaking China is ever going to happen. And so we're here on Taiwan, and we need to start looking at Taiwan not as just a staging ground, but actually the place where we are and the people as our people, and we are, you know, their government. And so we should start to do some things to benefit them and this place. So a lot of that resulted in economic development. And so a lot of people had very warm feelings. We're very thankful that, you know, Zhang Jingguo actually showed them some love and acceptance towards them, because actually I can even tell you that in my wife's time in school, and a lot of friends have spoken to me, that they weren't even allowed to speak Taiwanese language in school because it would be fine. In many cases, their teachers were from mainland China and they didn't understand that. And the government here, because it was from mainland China, they didn't want any Taiwanese dialect being spoken in school. They wanted everyone to learn Mandarin. Not dissimilar to what's going on in China now, where, you know, Mandarin is the official language and they don't want people speaking their native language or dialect. So a similar kind of thing. But yeah, I remember actually when I first came here, Zhang Jingguo was still alive. And about, oh, 3 or 4 months later, he died. And I was really surprised that a lot of young people that I ran into, that I knew and ran into, like on the day that Zhang Jingguo passed away, that they were crying. I'm like, you know, I'm not shocked that they were crying, because I remember as a kid when President Kennedy was killed and people were crying everywhere. But, you know, it just kind of, you know, Chinese people by and large are not very emotionally demonstrative. So to see that, you know, clear, you know, demonstration of the sadness and unto the point of crying and whatnot, I was, you know, a little touched and taken aback. I mean, nothing wrong with it, of course. And also, I didn't realize that they had that level of affection, you know, for him. And I found out that they did. So, interesting point. And now I guess understand why. One of the things he was very active in, as I said, shortly before I came there, he had just repealed martial law. So martial law is basically, you know, the military is kind of watching over things. There's a curfew. Things are strictly controlled. And I'll go into the details probably more in one of the future episodes. I think that today we'll probably end it fairly shortly. One thing I do want to say is that one of the things that were happening under Zhang Jingguo was, you know, the KMT was the only party here. Any other political parties were illegal. And one of the key political parties here that was active and had been fairly well persecuted was the DPP, or in Chinese, it's Minjingdang. So it's the Democratic Progressive Party. And so Zhang Jingguo made it clear that they would get legal status. He would open that up now. So when I got here, they were not fully legal. They were quasi-legal. So they can engage in certain activities, but they, you know, they could not participate in elections yet and whatnot. So one thing I will mention, I had a friend that was also from the States, and he was a videographer, so he had a background in video and video production. And his girlfriend was pretty active in the DPP. So this is still, I'm going to say this is probably around 1989, even 1990-ish. So again, I don't think the DPP could participate in any elections yet at that point, but it was getting pretty close. So it was kind of like, you know, they had, I think, legal status, but they were very much on a leash. And so I was kind of, I admire my friend, but I kind of felt like, you know, I need to be careful about being around him. My point being that since the DPP wasn't fully legal, and he was actually doing like a lot of video for them for their activities here in central Taiwan, and I felt the fact that he wasn't a citizen and engaged in that kind of stuff, I was kind of, you know, kind of shaky. And I, you know, I respect him for that, but I didn't want to get in any trouble for myself, because I didn't really have, I wasn't political. I didn't have really an opinion one way or the other, and I didn't want to be labeled as political because I knew him, or if I was hanging around him. So I kind of limited my my contact with him, but actually he did a lot of video work for them at the time. So all I will say is that it was pretty exciting to me, being from the States and having grown up during what I would call, as far as I knew, a fairly democratic society. At least I was told that. At the time, there was no internet. And, you know, I'll talk about my my childhood in school and whatnot. I mean, you know, we said the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag every day, and we had assembly once a week, and we had to wear a tie and all that kind of stuff. So we got brainwashed into the, you know, you don't realize that, you know, you're pledging allegiance to the flag. What's a flag? It's not a person. It's not a god. Well, it represents a state. The state is kind of like God under that model. And I'm not saying right or wrong. I think most nations do that. And, you know, here in Taiwan as well. But the exciting thing and my key point is that I felt I was really privileged to have that experience, to come here pretty much at the birth of Taiwan democracy. And it really was obvious because, you know, it was booming here economically. People were extremely busy. Most people worked, I want to say, a lot of them, if they worked in factories, they were probably working 7 days a week, 3 weeks, and maybe had one day off on one of the weeks. So, I mean, probably working all but one or two days a month, and a lot of times doing overtime. So, I mean, that kind of, they were really cranking it to keep up, you know, with the orders that were coming in. But, you know, it was just really, I feel like, a privilege and an honor to be here as democracy started happening. And one of the things that I noticed, I had a friend who was overseas Chinese. Actually, he and his family were basically from Korea. Originally, they're from Shandong, China. And so as many Chinese in Korea, they're usually from Shandong, because Shandong is very close, just across the peninsula from Korea. And nice people. They had like a food shop that was very close to the place I lived. And so the oldest boy was a graduate of Taiwan University, which is actually, that got started under the Japanese. It was Taiwan Imperial University, I believe, is the original name. And so he graduated from there, and a nice guy. And we were on the bus going somewhere together, going kind of into town. And I forget exactly what I was talking to him about, but obviously it had some political bent to it. And he got real quiet and kind of, you know, was like, "Mark, you know, certain topics are okay to know, but you don't want to talk about it because you never know who's listening." And I was surprised because he's, you know, a little bit paranoid. And as a contrast, right around the same time, I would pass Taiwanese guys that were getting off of work or just off from work, hanging out together, having a beer, having something to eat, and they'd be talking about the KMT or the current president, and what a joke, whatever the government's doing, and had no fear at all about, you know, what they were saying. And in fact, you know, were speaking loudly and openly. So, I mean, just like the two extremes. But later on, I found out, as I mentioned earlier, something called the White Terror. And so he probably had heard about that. And the White Terror, to make a long story short, it was a regime where basically, if you said anything untoward about the president, which was Chiang Kai-shek, or the government, you could easily get disappeared. Just like a lot of other dictatorships in South America, Eastern Europe, etc. And so I didn't know about that at the time, and I've learned about that more. And there was one famous incident, which now is a public holiday. When I came here, it was not. It's called 228, which marks February 28th. I forget the year. Maybe it was 1949 or so. And there was a big incident in southern Taiwan where basically some people were shot shot to death, and others were taken away and jailed, or, you know, you just disappeared, you never saw them again, over an alleged incident where people were selling cigarettes that weren't properly taxed, but a lot of people felt it was a ruse by the KMT government to just basically round up some people they viewed as a threat, which is, in this case, intellectuals. So there was always, there's a lot of mistrust and basically persecution of intellectuals by the government here. So consequently, the Democratic Progressive Party in their earliest days were formed primarily by Taiwanese intellectuals. So college graduates, some professors, doctors, educated people. So I think we'll close it for today on that point, and we will pick it up next time. So hopefully this is something interesting to you. Hopefully it's giving you some insight that you didn't have before, and we'll catch you on the next episode. So this is Mark saying thank you and talk to you soon. Bye.